This is John Costa and I'm here with Rob Watson, and we're at the Oby Granville Tennis Club today for the Leicester Rutland Family History Society's VE Day event. It's all set up now, lots of people sitting behind tables ready to listen to people's stories, hopefully look at some of their items, give them some feedback and some help with their family research. Another lady's just popped through the door there. Lots of display boards set up with stories about people from Oby, from the sort of roll of honour as, you know, 1939-1945, and it's nice to be here. Nice environment, the sun started to shine for VE Day, and we're going to be capturing some stories and voices of people for Spotlight on Heritage.
Well, have a look in the drawers. Nothing, sharp knife.
Oh, hello. I'm Sue Lester. I've got two hats on today, actually. One is I'm a member of a research group called Oby Remembering the Past. And the other one is, as you know, I'm the publicity officer for Leicestershire and Rutland Family History Society. And it's a joint event today at Oby Granville Tennis Club. And the club itself has got a very interesting history, actually, because it was formed in 1947. And it was following on from the community spirit that was created during the Second World War, and particularly the street parties for VJ Day. And they got some land and they developed a tennis club. And so the tennis club is 80 years old next year as well. So it's quite poignant in a way that we're holding the event here, because the tennis club really owes its origins to what was going on locally in the Second World War.
So just guide us through what's here today in terms of, and what the kind of commemoration for VE Day is about.
Well, one of the things we did back in 2018 was we commemorated the soldiers on the war memorial from the First World War. So one of the exhibitions we've put together is the list of soldiers from the Second World War who are commemorated on the Oby War Memorial. And we've done some very preliminary research about those soldiers. So we're hoping people might come with a bit more information. We've got photos of street parties from Oby specifically. We've got information about evacuation in Oby. We've got information about a whole range of other things within the Oby community, like civil defence, etc., during the Second World War, because we're hoping that people will come whose parents possibly were involved in these events and might have photographs or recollections from their parents to share with us today.
And it's not just about reinforcing a myth, is it, of, you know, the unredoubtable victory, you know, over the Nazis, that kind of thing. It's also about remembering and identifying the complexity of life here in Leicester and Oby, and what's changed.
Well, yes, I mean, we've seen a lot of changes, and our research group has actually tried to log some of those changes. A lot of the research we do is prior to 1960 and modern development. So the home front in the First World War, home front in the Second World War is really quite important, because people don't quite know what Oby was like before the modern shops in the parade, etc. And if you look around, actually, in Oby, there's still lots of evidence of older Oby. So the idea is we might generate interest in, you know, what was that building? Who lived there? Maybe it was somebody who'd fought in the Second World War. We've got some lists of absent voters. On VE Day 1945, there were 411 Oby men and women still fighting, or still overseas. So they weren't at home in Britain celebrating VE Day. And there's been quite a lot of references to, look, don't forget about VJ Day. You know, some of the VE Day celebrations are possibly, in some people's eyes, forgetting that there were still a lot of servicemen still overseas. And we've actually got some lists, if people want to look at them, where they can see whether, you know, their grandfather or great uncle or father was actually away fighting, because the lists give the names and they also give where they were living when they were at home. But they were absent when the general election took place, basically.
And looking at some of the photos from the that you've got of the street parties, you kind of don't get a sense, or what have you, how do you read those photographs to get a sense of what the kind of commitment and sacrifice people at home were had undertaken, and then how that went, because it, you know, austerity carried on, post-war austerity carried on for another a few years after that, but then there was also, it led to the change of government, and it led to the birth of the NHS and things like that. Is there something that's captured in these images and these stories of this day that maybe, you know, how do you read that?
Well, I think a lot of the photographs have got an emphasis on children in particular, so you get the sense that maybe having had the years of war and very difficult times with a father away in service, that possibly some of the celebrations were particularly geared at them as a little celebration. There's obviously women there. There aren't that many men in the photographs. I don't know whether you've noticed that. So clearly, you know, I mentioned these absent voters, so some of the men had not come home. But I think there was a strong sense of community. You know, we've got, well, we found 7 or 8 photographs from Odeby, from newspapers, where streets were putting together celebrations in the way that they have done more recently, you know, when it was the Queen's Silver Jubilee, people had street parties. And I think they kind of must have built on that, because I'm not sure they had street parties prior to V-Day. I might be wrong on that. But I think there was a strong sense of community, basically, and I think that's what comes through in a lot of the photographs that we've certainly found while we've been putting this exhibition together.
And you couldn't just go to the local Costco or Tesco and buy a load of sandwiches and cakes. You made it yourself, so the celebrations and the commemoration is very much included self-made food, and you know, is there a record of how people approached that kind of thing?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure about records in Odeby, but obviously with rationing, it was simple pleasures, basically. You know, a simple cake that was made eggless, quite possibly. There were lots of recipes put out for things like eggless cakes. And sandwiches might just be really basic jam. You know, people weren't expecting the kind of things that you might get nowadays, as you say. And they made paper hats sometimes out of newspapers and, you know, made their own bunting. It was all this sort of, let's make our own entertainment, let's make our own food. We're not going to go out and buy ready-made sandwiches. You know, if you think about how things have changed with that. It was just sort of simple pleasures, really, and it comes across. The food wasn't the important thing in these V-Day parties. It was more about celebration within the community, friends, families. We've had people today who've come and said, oh, that's my mother on that particular photo, you know, that's really nice. We've had one or two people get in touch to say they recognise people in some of the photos.
So if there was one thing, last question, if there's one thing that you can take that you've been surprised about and that you've uncovered, what would you, for you personally, what would you point to?
The irony of this is I'm not from Odeby, but I've got very invested in the local community and some of the families. A whole range of things, really. I mean, there was one lady just recently who said her mother was born the day that Leicester was bombed in 1940. And you kind of think, wow. And I know another friend who told me that her father and grandmother were in another area of Leicester, and the child was wanting to look in a shop window, and the mother pulled him away. And 2 minutes later, a bomb went off on that particular street. And I think that's spine-chilling, you know, when you hear stories like that, alongside the things that were going on V-Day.
So how do people get in contact with you and find more information about the work that you do?
Well, there's two things. If you've got particularly interested in Odeby, we've got a Facebook group called Odeby Remembering the Past. So anyone with an interest in Odeby particularly, very welcome to join that. You don't have to, you know, live in Odeby particularly. You don't have to have come from Odeby. In terms of family history, we've got a research centre in every street, but we can also be contacted via our website and also via our email address, which is publicity lrfhs.org.uk, and we'd love to help you if you're getting started on family history. We can particularly help you if you're looking at World War II research and you want to know how you apply for a service record, maybe a father, an uncle, or whether you just want to see information that we might be able to find out. More recent history can be more difficult to research, but if you think we can help in any way, please get in touch.
And to get Rob to introduce himself, how are you doing today, Rob?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Now, we were talking earlier, obviously, I'm from the East End of London, you know, you're from Liverpool, and we were just talking about, you know, how people tend to be dominated by conversations around football and bits and pieces. And, of course, the conversation came round today to VE Day and families and family stories, and sometimes if it's a big thing, you kind of know about it, there's a big family story, and sometimes there isn't, is it? You're not sure, you know grandparents were like working on the trains or roofers and stuff, but if those kind of conversations are not kept going by the older generation and stuff, then the younger people in the family won't necessarily know about those stories, will they?
On a personal level, I've got no connections, no stories. They're never really circulated within our family about that period and what happened. And it was never, you're right, it's like kind of the stories can easily be lost. And there's always an interest in these things of what were you doing, what happened then. Maybe it's my fault, but I couldn't tell you. Historyless.
Yeah, and I think unless it's something that's a big deal in your family. I mean, I'm named John William, as I've said to you before. You know, both of the John and William were killed in the war, one in the army, one in the air force. And then my dad lost his dad, and I would say that my dad suffered intergenerational trauma his entire life when it came to World War II, simply from, you know, whether it was COVID wasn't going to get him because Hitler didn't, because he survived the Blitz, or just his view of Japanese people, his view of German people, his view of military service and stuff like that. And I think growing up in that environment, and my nan's service during the war and stuff, that you get used to, it's something I'm interested in now, particularly with my dad passing away and joining the Family History Society. It's more about who can I uncover that has done, you know, service, who's been in the army like I have. My son's in the army now. It's part of your family, and when it isn't, and it's not a central theme, it's very difficult to think about, where do I start? I guess that's why these days are important, isn't it?
And there's fewer people with the direct experience. You know, it's like we saw the pictures of the king and the tea party the commemoration last week, and those people who've got, you know, that who served, who, you know, were moving on from that. And so it's the generation that followed, and then it's the generation that followed that, and that direct experience is something. And how long can you carry on remembering these kind of events? You know, it does at some point society has to move on from it, but for the right reasons rather than the wrong reasons. And it as that memory fades, but we're looking at, I mean, there's a lot of old photographs to look at and newspaper clippings that we can look at here today, and that'll be interesting to chat with people about.
So the event's going really well today, nice and busy, lots of people coming in, which is always nice when you set up and put all this effort in, and volunteers come and set up tables and stuff. And I've managed to catch, because she hasn't got anybody with her at the moment, so I thought I'd dive in quick. Sue Shaw, how are you, Sue?
Yeah, fine, thank you.
So you're telling me that you're 25 years now, yeah?
Yeah, 25th year with the Family History Society. Yeah. Okay.
So what are you doing here today? What's your specialism? What are you hoping to speak to people about?
I've come along to be supportive, and because I'm interested, and I bought some stuff that I found out about my dad and my mum, and just to talk to people in general. Telling people how to find records, Second World War records, and yeah, it's great. Really interesting.
So talk us through this little display that you've got here. I'll take a photograph for people to look at. And you mentioned about your dad and your mum. So today's obviously VE Day, 8th of May. So tell us a little bit about their backstory and, after the war.
Dad's Raymond Ernest Page, born in Leicester 1922. And he joined up in the Second World War, interrupted his engineering apprenticeship, to join up. And he was, when he became active, he was on a Lancaster bomber. On his 25th mission, he was shot down over Denmark and taken a prisoner of war. He was on one of the forced marches when the Russians were advancing. He was marched west by the Germans and eventually liberated, got back to England. So, you know, he was lucky, really. I did do a visit to Denmark in 2014 and saw where the plane came down and saw he and the pilot survived. And I saw where the other five were buried in the local churchyard. And when I came back, the locals who were allowed to metal detect when the crops had been gathered in, and one of them found a navigator's watch. And theirs was the only plane that was shot in that area. It had got a thing on the back with the year 1941 when he joined up. So it was his.
So you actually got that returned to you?
You've got that returned to you?
Yes, I've got it. I've got the watch, yeah.
Now, can I ask you, I mean, you know, military service, I was in the army, my son's in the army now, so, you know, doing lots of research about the family. I think we're about 25 members of our family, an extended family, back to World War One, have had some kind of military service. Now, what kind of impact do you think the war had on your father when he returned? Did he speak about it openly? Was it something that he didn't speak about at all? You know, what kind of impact do you think it had on him?
Well, there's no telling. I mean, they a lot of them don't say, do they? I mean, it must have been horrific, really. I mean, when they were doing the false war, they had no transport, no proper clothes, no food, walking in the middle of the night in snow. It must have been horrific. And he said what he missed most as a prisoner was, apart from the food, no toothpaste and no toilet paper, right, which stuck in my mind. But when they were doing this march, the food was very limited, and he said raw potatoes don't taste very nice.
Now, was he alive to see the return of the Navigator watch, or had he passed away by then?
No, he died in 1996.
And so what kind of connection, how does that make you feel to have this return to you, this something that you knew belonged to him, and he thought was lost as well?
Just magic, really. You couldn't make the story up, could you? Getting your dad's burnt Navigator's watch out of a field in Denmark. I mean, just magic. They also gave me the bits of the plane, you know, bits of the perspex glass and an oil gate, filter gauge that was, you could just about recognise it, you know, and things like that. So it was good. The local historian had found some bits out and he said, one of the sad parts was he decided not to run away when he was not a scratch on him when he landed. Parachute opened okay. The pilot was badly burnt and had skin grafts in hospital and all this. But he said he didn't want the local people to be hurt or forced to do anything, so he didn't resist. And two local policemen were sent out to find him, and which they did. And he was taken to that's his interrogation card. And then he said he was put in solitary confinement for 2 weeks, and then he was taken to a prisoner of war camp. But this local historian said that about a month after, the SS arrived and took away these two policemen, accused them of collaborating with the local underground. And these two policemen apparently were taken to a concentration camp, never seen again.
So your dad was right about reprisals and the impact that it would have had on locals.
Because I was hoping that I knew where he was taken, and we actually went to the place where this police station was. I was hoping these policemen or their descendants would still be around, you know. But on hearing that, I thought that was really, really sad.
Now, having a personal story like this, a connection to, you know, a big event like this, you know, your own story about your dad, how much of that do you draw on when you're trying to help other people who are maybe at the foothills of trying to find out about their own family story?
Go out there and look. You know, there's the the military, the records, a lot of people say, oh, I'm not interested in military. I mean, I'm not particularly interested in battles and all this sort of thing.
It's people, isn't it?
Records that it actually coughs up. And I mean, this is my mum who was in the Land Army, and this is her Land Army card. And that, you know, you can get a record from that of when she joined the Land Army and when she left, you know. Just absolute magic, I think.
Yeah. I mean,
you can get the records are all being moved now from the Second World War. Records are going from the MOD, and they're all stored apparently all over the country, all the different types of records for Army, Navy and Air Force. And they're all being transferred now to Kew, to the National Archives. And they've started. It's going to take so many years to do. But eventually they'll all be there and you'll be able to access them, the same as you can the First World War records. And all we have to do is you fill in this inquiry form. This is about you. And then you have to prove that they're dead, unless the date of birth's more than 100 years from when they died. And then you fill in the appropriate forms, one for all the services. And obviously, the more you know about them, the easier it will be for the records to be found. But you need to do a bit of detective work beforehand. You know, if you're in the army, do you know what regiment they're in? If you've got a picture of them with their cap badge on, that I can identify them. And then obviously the Air Force, what squadron were they in? And the Navy, you know, what ship were they on? And you identify things like that. And the more you know, but you need to be sensible. You've got the death certificate. From that, from the death indexes, you can find when they were born, because nowadays it gives you their date of birth on the death index. So you got that. Prior to, I think, in the 1960s, it gave you their age when they died. So you can work out the date of birth from that. And the General Register Office now publish the age of the person that died right from 1837 on their website. So you've got a pretty good chance if you don't know when they were born. A lot of people don't. They say things like, I've no idea when my granny was born, and you say to them, well, did you go to a funeral? And they say, well, yeah, I was 10. So that narrows it down to they can work out when their granny died, they can look on the death index, and then from that you can find their year of birth.
So things like the internet and sort of, you know, digitisation and things like that have made this thing a lot easier now, but you still have to put the footwork in, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. It's not so exciting. There's nothing better than going to an archive or record office and discovering something you've been wondering about for years. Nothing like now you go to your computer, you press a button and up it comes. It's easier, but it's not so exciting. There's not the thrill of discovering a hidden document somewhere and, you know, learning from that.
Now, one of the other things about, interestingly, since my dad died last year, me and my mum have joined the Family History Society, and mum's investigating certain people in the family that she wants to know about, and I'm doing all the military related stuff. And the interesting thing, talking to Sue Lester, who my colleague Rob interviewed earlier, was just talking about the fact that people tend to get in touch with the society as well and just say, like, I've got so far on Ancestry or Find My Past. And of course, they make it look so easy on Who Do You Think You Are, because they've got this army of people doing the work and you have to do the work yourself. So you guys actually open doors for people.
And those that where they researched abroad in a different language and that, they would have to employ a local researcher, definitely. But the TV programmes distort it a bit. They go there and they open a book and there's a marker in, and they turn, oh, you look down that page, and they look, and then, oh yes, there they are, you know. And if it was you, you'd probably be there all week and not find it. But it's more fun to find it yourself.
And do you enjoy the social side of it as well, because you get to go out and talk to people and come to events like this as well?
Meetings, and we talk to people there, and the events like this where you're interacting with people. And we in the old days we used to have bus trips to the National Archives and Family Records Centre in London, and it was painful because it was like a 7 a.m. start, you know. And you'd,
how committed
you'd,
am I?
You set your alarm for 5:30, and then you know at 6:30 you'd head to the where you were getting the coach. And but when you got to the National Archives at 9:30, you'd be, thank God I came, you know, and you find something absolutely wonderful, and you think, well, what the heck, just getting up early a couple of more, you know, a morning, nothing really.
Yeah, that little bit of commitment, lovely. Thanks for speaking to me, Sue. Thank you for the question. Now, one story in my family is obviously with my granddad dying in Italy in 1944. In 1945, in the street where my dad grew up. When it was VE Day, there was a big street party. So my nan took my dad out and his sister, who's 5 years older, who can actually remember my dad's dad. He can't remember his dad. Took him out in the street, well, for one song, and then they went inside. So his memory of VE Day is other people enjoying themselves because the war was over, whereas in fact it was one song outside on the piano and then coming back in. And actually his dad was the only person in their street to die. But their house survived. It wasn't bombed like everybody else's. So you kind of got this yin and yang of the whole thing. And he can remember seeing, like, you know, plane trails in the sky. He can remember seeing the very first black person, American GIs who were guarding German prisoners that were there clearing up after bombing, you know, the rubble and stuff like that. So it stayed with him, I would say, his entire life until he passed away last year.
I suppose the danger is that you kind of have an enforced story that, you know, and there's no difference of opinion, and it's actually reality is more complex than that, and people have lots of different experiences and points of view, and, you know, it's like, you know, we can tell ourselves everybody was out on the streets having a party on VE Day, and it's not true. You know, it's only one element of it, and understanding what else was going on, as important as it was, and it is to, you know, keep it in mind and commemorate it, and the achievement that was, and the sacrifice that was made. But at the same time, it's like, don't just think that it's one-dimensional. You know, there's multiple layers to this. And that's what you get when you're talking to people. You find out those intricacies of those things. So.
I think also that when you look at, you know, our political system now and what's going on in the world and stuff, then there's that kind of context between the fact that, you know, our former enemies, you know, are now our allies in things like NATO or, you know, part of Europe and stuff. But then also you've got this scenario where when you look at conflict and, you know, who's our friend, who's our enemy, who's that kind of, you know, coalition of the willing, all these kind of conversations that you have, that you don't think about, you know, the impact on people, you know, the people in those countries, those that weren't, you know, part of military forces, or, you know, the people that died in the Dresden firebombings, for example. Or we were talking about Tokyo earlier, wasn't it? Your upcoming visit to Japan, we were talking about the bombs or the firebombs on Tokyo. These were civilians that were dying. They were men, women, children, that kind of stuff, not necessarily combat forces. And this is the thing, we kind of draw people into that, and we allow politicians to use some of those memories to get us to feel a certain way. So it's that kind of the Dunkirk spirit, you know, the Blitz, they're sort of, you know, the attack on Churchill's statue, you know, all of these kind of things that they're used as a way of creating a certain particular emotion in people, isn't it, about, you know, fighting, getting our country back and all these sorts of stuff. We need to be very careful about how we pick those emotions.
Yeah, it's kind of replaying a myth. You make the points really well, and the other side to it is that this is an opportunity for people to get together and reflect on those things and have a cup of tea and a piece of cake. And the effort that we do, you know, it's a very British way of, you know, working through these issues, is sit down and have a cup of tea and a slice of cake. You know, that'll solve most of the world's problems. So.
And I was interested, I was talking to someone that I know as well, that she was... this was a while ago now. She was at a meeting about veterans, and there was this sort of slightly pompous old duffer, you know, in uniform and stuff. And he was talking about, like, you know, oh, so and so the Indians and sort of stuff like that. And she said, well, actually, you know, they it wasn't India yet. You know what I mean? It was like the, you know, the Indian subcontinent. It was still a British colony and stuff like that. So you're talking about this almost like now we're looking back and go, oh, they were all Indians. Well, you know, they weren't. You know, some of them were like people that were, you know, it then became Pakistan or it then became Bangladesh. I mean, we need to also think about while we're trying to include people that were from the former empire colonies and stuff like that, that we're also thinking about who it was and why they were fighting at that time, because normally you'd fight for Britain in order to throw off the shackles post-war.
And a number of those issues aren't resolved yet. You know, we're living through, you know, the conflict, potential conflict escalating between India and Pakistan. You know, so it's not, you know, this it never goes away.
I was saying we've got a picture of Mummy up here somewhere or other.